Welcome to Reality TV, the podcast where we cringe watch all the shows we love and love to hate. I'm Jody, your source for snarky reality TV recaps from all the networks across the board. No one is off limits as I dissect even the tiniest details of our favorite train wrecks. Be sure to follow up between episodes on Twitter and Instagram at Reality TV Pod. Snark with me and fellow listeners on Facebook in the Reality TV Podcast Orchard of Snark group. And for nitty-gritty, unfiltered me, check out bonus episodes at patreon.com/realitypod. All right, let's get to the good stuff. Back again for a big old polygamous party today. I don't know if it was just a long day for me yesterday or if I'm just so damn sick and tired of this wedding planning, but last night's episode of Sister Wives felt like it was never going to end. And I'm like you, I love Sister Wives, I will watch it no matter what, but 2 hours every Sunday? Am I the only one struggling with this time commitment? Well, let's just get right to it because there was a lot of really good, really bad stuff to unpack. First up, Mary. Because, of course, she always has to be first. Now, I swear on the Brown family mission statement that every scene with Mary begins with her next to an armless side chair. A little coy look on her face saying, "So, I've called the adults over to talk about something. I don't know how they're going to take it or what they're going to think, so I'm a little nervous about it." Mary, trust that the rest of the cul-de-sac is equally nervous to see what pipe dream they're going to be getting sold on this time. And this time, Mary is really outdoing herself. She's just doubling down to do whatever she can to make the other four send her packing. Because now she has changed her mind about the house in Parowan. You see, she asked her mom if she would ever want to live in the house, but her mom said no. However, her mom then changed her mind and said she wants to live there. So now Mary's just dumping the whole part where they're going to keep the house as a B&B, and she's just going to buy it for her mom. Well, the ladies trickle in, as does Cody, all of them expressing the sense of doom that comes whenever they enter Mary's house. Because, you know, obviously they don't see her that often and it's not a house they even feel comfortable in. Without any sincere worry for their approval, Mary spells out the massive detour that she's decided to take. In my opinion, she's just using her mom as the scapegoat here. "My mom wants to live there. I mean, she can't run a B&B, but my mom wants to live there." Well, Janelle and Christine are just incredulous and keep asking her to repeat herself. "So you're not gonna buy it?" "No, I'm gonna buy it, but I'm just not gonna run it as a B&B." "So you're still gonna buy it?" I mean, I just loved when Janelle looked at Mary and goes, "So would you just buy it and not try to make an income?" It was great. Well, Mary was all, "Yeah, I try to, but because my mom wants to live there." Janelle, God love her, doesn't back down when she talks business sense, so she just kept on going. "Do you think it would be overpriced for just a home? Because turns out the current owner wants to sell the house as is with all the shit inside of it, all the furnishings." And Janelle says, "It just seems to me that you'd have to have it as a business to justify purchasing it." Robin says it's complicated and she needs to think about it, but yeah, you're going to have to sell some more LuLaRoe leggings to finance this, Mary. But my girl Christine just lays it out there. It's kind of dumb. But she went a little nastier in her interview, which I loved. "It's kind of dumb. It's nice, but she just wants a home so her mom can live in it. But how about you get a smaller home?" Now, let's remember that Christine has extra reason to be upset because her mom was supposed to live in that house and run it. Remember, Mary got her hopes all up and she was going to have her live there, a home set to go, a job all for her. Oh, nope. Just screw Christine's mom over too. I'd be pissed if I were Christine. Why doesn't Christine just get to go buy a house for her mom? Why does Queen Mary get to pull this shit off? Okay, now guys, I hate to admit this, but maybe it's who I'm seeing him compared to this season, but I'm kind of liking Cody. He's a total attention-hungry dork, we know that. But he's showing some scenes where he has a spine and he's not just blowing smoke, especially with Mary. So Cody just shades Mary so succinctly and asked, well, how's your direct sales business going? Yeah, we're talking the LuLaRoe clothing. She yells at people to buy live on Facebook. I'm not kidding. Go search LuLaRoe Mary Brown on Facebook and don't you dare say I sent you or buy anything. We're there to see something, say something only. Mary responds that her job as a social retailer, could handle a mortgage payment. And Cody immediately cuts her off by saying, well, that's for a bank to decide. Well, my snooping a few weeks ago confirms that they did decide. I don't know how none of them called her on it when they asked her how long she's been thinking about this change in plans. And Mary says, well, this just all came up like a week or 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks? That's kind of a long time to know something. Or is it really that Mary's just not around that often? The other wives are still shocked about this decision of hers because that's what it was, a decision. They're not as gullible as Mary thinks they are. All three of them said they don't even know why Mary had them there. What is she expecting them to say? They don't know what she wants because she's going to do whatever she wants to do anyway. But you know who ain't gonna go down lying and take it anymore? Cody. He said in his interview, we're not gonna tell her that we're going to support her mom when we have children that we're still raising and supporting. Preach, Sister Cody. Yeah, why should the rest of the family have to sacrifice and take from their own children to take care of Mary's mom? How about move old mom into one of your extra four bedrooms in that house? Well, they all leave to think about it, and they hug her goodbye and promise to text her about it later. Yeah, because they don't even sound like they're close neighbors, let alone sister wives who supposedly share in raising the children. Now, the real good stuff comes when Cody gets stuck being alone with Mary. He was backing away the whole time. He couldn't wait to run out of there and find solace in anyone but Mary. He would have rather watched Truly's plays again than be stuck in that house of hickory-smoked LuLaRoe. So Mary thinks she can convince Cody to give his consent on this Parowan house if he actually goes inside to see it. They've driven by, but he's never been in it. Well, Cody's response sounded something like this. Okay? Now, he says he has no interest because the place is so old, it's going to need massive updating repairs. But I think he really just doesn't want to be stuck alone with Mary in a car for hours or anywhere alone with her if he doesn't have to. Here it is, the whispers from the universe telling us to listen to that path, follow that journey. Cody says, Mary and I aren't working on our relationship. We're not that involved. We're more like a divorced couple living on the same block. We're bound by people and things, but not bound by a personal relationship. He said, more like a divorced couple living on the same block. Well, that's because you are a divorced couple living on the same block. I hate to cheer on a couple to split up, but dang, these two are just not happy. Why not just go off, do your own thing separately? All right, enough of that deep stuff. Let's get to the taco buffet. We're a few days away from McKelty's wedding. Christine is packing. She's doing McKelty's hair, along with 1,000 other things. I gotta give it to her. And then we get this incredibly touching scene with Isabel and Christine. We don't hear much from Isabel because it's normally Gwendolyn and Truly stealing the show. Turns out Isabel has a very aggressive case of scoliosis, so she has to wear a nighttime and daytime brace. God, I felt so terribly for her. I have to say, her wardrobe did disguise the brace pretty damn well, and Christine was such a good mom for how she was handling it and talking to Isabel. But when Isabel started crying about how hard it is to wear the brace and how painful it was, leaves her with bruises and the emotional toll it takes on her. God, I mean, I was full on mom tears pouring out of my eyes. Those middle school years are hellish for everyone, and I cannot imagine how hard that is, having to wear a back brace on top of it. I just hope that she has some good friends and there's no asshole kids giving her a hard time. And Isabel, or someone who knows Isabel, I know the Orchard and I will personally go handle any little bitches that try and give Isabel a hard time. You hear that, Nell, the woman who left me a review on iTunes that I'm cruel and I hate children? Tell that to the other two families that I helped create and Isabel. Yeah, so there. All right, well, hey, what's that? Donde está McKelty y Christine? They're at the Cinder Block Salon in picturesque St. George, Utah, getting manicures. That salon was so depressing. Lizzie's prison cell on Love After Lockup was more uplifting than this place. Christine has been brushing up on her Spanish, and quite frankly, I was pleasantly surprised and relieved to hear her say she was practicing Spanish instead of, "I've been learning to speak Mexican," because my head would have just exploded like Tony's pinata had she said that. Christine can now say, "¿Dónde está el baño?" and "Mi familia." She sounded like that Adam Sandler CD, "They're All Gonna Laugh at You." Was I the only one that remembers this? And now the severe beating of a high school Spanish teacher. And no, Nell, I'm not advocating beating up teachers. Take it easy. So, back to work. McKelty is loving all this attention. And she also loves fake fabric flowers. She's put the entire army of friends and family to work, making 7,000 petals so they can be sewn into flowers for her bridesmaids, groomsmen, her bouquet, centerpieces. Bitch be crazy. These things look like shit. Sorry, not sorry. They're horrible. The handle is from Michaels, and they spent quite a bit of cash, I'm assuming, on all that fabric and thread and time, all that other shit. Order some simple flowers and tie them together with some ribbon. Maybe pop a few of your little fabric flowers in there. Done. Now, these flowers have gotten so out of hand, even Tony the Taco King, who requires 4,000 tacos, thinks it's too much. He and McKelty have been arguing about it. Tony refuses to help her because he's Tony. And when they tell his mom, Maria, about it in the nail salon, she just shrugs her shoulders and goes, "Eh." Pretty sure "eh" is Spanish for, "He's going to suck the life out of you. I myself have given up on him years ago." Fast forward to a very important rehearsal. Not for the wedding, for Christine's solo performance of "Let Me Call You Sweetheart." She's found a guitarist to accompany her. She's told him to jazz it up a little bit. And they're practicing at the pawn shop turned officiant's house. I think the homeowners thought they were going to be visited by Carter Osterhaus from the Great Christmas Light Fight because this place was decked to the fucking halls. No nook nor cranny was skipped by the Hobby Lobby Christmas Fairy. Christine starts singing, and immediately they were competing on two different American Idol seasons. Guitar Man was way down here, and Christine was way up here. She's so nervous, and she keeps repeating that she's been practicing higher. I live in the high notes. That's where I'm comfortable. Well, that makes one of us. You guys, someone needs to tell her that it is okay not to sound like she's just sucked on a helium tank. I actually think she'd be fairly good at singing if she just brought it down several octaves. The guitarist nor the rest of us know what this song is going to sound like, but I cannot wait. Well, let's check in with the bride. McKelty and Aspen are at McKelty's apartment. Where in the holy hell does she live? Does she live in a maze? There are doors leading to nowhere, but also everywhere. There seems to be a strange storage room off the main living space, but it's separated by curtains. Also a kitchen with an entry door, but no one entered through it. And then Christine pulled Cody into McKelty's room, which also had an outside door. She lives in a labyrinth. And what a labyrinth it is. This place is like Hoarders Junior. Shit everywhere. I could not live in a place like that. Instant seasonal depression would set in because there seems to be no source of natural light. Oh, but they had a wall of bookcases and a huge artificial Christmas tree. I know I missed some commentary by whoever was there because I was scanning the piles of stuff everywhere from crock pots to freaking samurai swords, two of them on the wall. And in this apartment of filth, Aspen is still working away on these flower petals with McKelty. I love Aspen because she's so sweet, but also honest. McKelty fancies herself pretty practical and clever because her bridesmaids will get to keep their fabric bouquets after the wedding for decoration. So help me, if that is her gift to her bridesmaids for standing up in the wedding, oh my God. I don't know about you, but I would be donating that piece of shit before I ever even made it out of my car. Christine, Cody, and friends Rachel and Tristan arrived to help. Tristan had an interesting look, right? But for Nell's sake, I'm going to hold off on Tristan, and I'm going to save it for Truly in a moment. They're filling the giant bride and groom piñatas with Mexican candy for Tony because, did you know he's Mexican? And Tony says,
"And we're going to fill her with generic white people candy. Halloween stuff is going to come out of you."
And they're going to get to beat these piñatas during the reception, all while a Mexican song plays in the freezing cold because it's an outside wedding in December. Now, I'll spare the talk of weather for 40 minutes because all we need to know is it's cold in the winter. But the song that they are going to be beating these things to is called Dale, 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 and I found myself watching at least four different versions on YouTube. Christine finally gets to give McKelty the flowers she made from slicing up her wedding dress, and Tony got his Clotta ring from Christine. And when she gave Tony the ring, he goes, "A cow ring? Wow." Yeah, Tony, a cow ring. It's a white people thing. Later that night, Cody and Christine head to Chris the officiant's house to iron out the details of the ceremony. McKelty and Tony requested a unique and fun ceremony. So Chris has used that frisbee for his inspiration. Once again, I'm shaking my head at myself because I'm agreeing with Cody. He thinks the whole thing with the Frisbee is trite. That's a nice word for it. I'm just calling it lame or stupid. Same, same. But hey, at least there's going to be moments of seriousness and elegance. For example, the Frisbees that Christine has planned for 400 people to throw in perfect arches, never intersecting, that will glide over the couple as they say I do. They all have those different sayings and pictures the younger girls drew on them back in Vegas, remember? Oh, Maria, que dice? The pants are very pretty on your legs. I'm so dirty. Oh, that silly Gwendolyn. She's always cracking those jokes about pantalones. I feel like Truly and Gwendolyn have a lot in common, no? Back in Vegas, Robin and her cousin and sister are wrangling all the kids to head out to Utah. Some of the kids have the sniffles. And I see Robin has scored herself quite a large leather sectional after she became Mrs. Brown officially. Interesting. Well, back at the North Pole, Tony and McKelty are punching out hearts to use as confetti. Something tells me that they would not have been able to use that anyway, right? Like you use birdseed or bubbles so you don't have stuff flying around littering Mother Earth, right? I can't see a golf club being cool with pounds of tiny paper flying around the golf course and then out into those natural areas beyond it. They're just selfish idiots. And this is the exact type of thing that Cody reminds McKelty of when she says, I've been counting down every day, like literally to the day. Oh, really, McKelty? Like you're the first bride ever to count down to the literal day of the wedding? Jesus, she's so stupid. Well, Cody reminds them to, you know what, forget all the little stuff. The wedding is about the marriage, not the wedding. Wow, Cody, once again, that's actually pretty safe advice. With my weddings, we got caught up in the knee news. Okay, well, now you went too far. Do not bring Robin Williams or Mork into this, Cody. That is sacred ground. Easy there. Fast forward to the rehearsal. Despite the weather making it look depressing and soggy, McKelty thinks the rain brought out the red and green, and it actually enhanced the ambiance. Okay, sure, Jan. The only enhanced colors I noticed were McKelty's red roots and black ends on her hair, and Christine's nose is strangely greenish-gray in her interviews. Back at the club, Tanya, the wedding planner, takes a Vicodin and vodka chaser and heads out to meet the crew outside, where it looks like they're reporting from a hurricane. Tony's bros men, are just standing around. Truly is rolling in the hay and on the putting green. And Tanya is losing her goddamn mind. I don't know what planet McKelty lives on, but she thinks Tanya is just all good. She's got it covered. And Tony interjects, she's kind of a beast. Okay? Kian? This is when Mr. Reality TV looked up and goes, whoa. And at that same moment, we both realized that not only is Tony an asshole, but the entire wedding party is trotting all over the actual putting green. Tanya herself, who works there, is walking all over it in heels. Now, those of you who know golf No, you don't just walk all over the green in any old shoes, especially if it's raining, and you don't walk on it at all unless you have to. Fun fact, Mr. Reality TV used to be a golf pro, and he got his degree in golf management. Don't mean to brag, but he knows his grass blades. And anyway, he was floored that they would have anyone out there like that, especially Tanya, who works there. He was just going off. That putting green right there looks like it's at least $100,000. No way should someone who works there not know that and be walking on it. All right, so let's just add the cost to repair the putting green to that $4,000 taco tab. Luckily, the wedding party survives the rehearsal without frostbite. Cody might have lost a few remaining strands of hair on his head in the wind, but they're all just happy to be inside, thawing out, at a bowling alley. fun. So glad I got you a gift and paid for my dress and travel and hotel, and you're getting a large pizza and a pitcher free of caffeine-free Sprite to share. Yay. Now, I hadn't noticed until now, and I think it's because Tony's always sitting his lazy ass down, but he and McKelty have matching bodies, like the exact same body shape. No doubt about it, they could share jeans or flannel pants, easy peasy. Guess who else was there? Truly. You may not have seen her because she was crawling on the ground. And also, Maddie and Caleb are there. Maddie is bullying like she's 13 months pregnant already. I was ready for her to take out her What to Expect book while she was waiting for the next frame. And then Caleb comes over and he's baby talking to her belly. Again, isn't he like 30-something, too old to be doing this shit? He acts so immature, it's embarrassing. But you know what my favorite part of that whole party was? Mary was holding baby Areola, and the camera pans to Robin, who's filling up a cup, and she is side-eyeing Mary, holding her baby so intensely. Robin isn't stupid. She knows to keep an eye on Mary. And if Robin is as smart as I think she's capable of being, she'd push Mary to move to that Parowan house. And then it's hers. All hers. The wet bar. Kristen and Jen, the creators of the hilarious I Mom So Hard, are taking their friendship and funny to the stage in I Mom So Hard Live. Tony is going to choke on his street tacos when he hears the best part. These talented ladies just got picked up by CBS to get their own TV show. So if you're in the Reno area, you can see them at the Silver Legacy Casino on Saturday, March 3rd. Tickets start at only $39 if you go to silverlegacy.com and get this, 20% off your room for the night if you use promo code TICKS18. Make a girl's weekend out of it. Trust me, you'll be laughing all night. Again, go to silverlegacy.com and use promo code TICKS18 and get 20% off your room for the night with your ticket purchase. Let's jump right on into the dating pool on Seeking Sister Wife with the Snowdens of Atlanta. Demetri and Ashley are still digging their new potential wife, 22-year-old Jocelyn. They are two adorable kids who are well-behaved, Nell, are hanging around, and I want to squeeze them and give them all the ice cream they want because they are seriously adorable kids. Jocelyn sends Demetri a text that she's off next weekend and she can fly out to meet them in person if they're up for it. So they text her back that they love to meet her and they're excited at the possibility that Jocelyn might just be that special someone to help build their family and help out around the house. Producers asked them to refold some sheets and towels because I know that those pillowcases were clean already because they had distinct fold marks in them already. So while they're refolding, they decide to go on a group date first. They're going to make this a time when Jocelyn can learn what their dynamic is as a couple and a family before Jocelyn goes out on a romantic date with Demetri. So fast forward to date night, and they're looking all fresh and clean and ready to go polygadate. They're at a cool-looking restaurant, and I gotta tell you, I kept looking at whatever Ashley was drinking. I don't know if it was just muddled limes and water. Whatever kind of mocktail it was, it looked divine. Well, here she comes, weighing in at my birth weight of 9 pounds, 4 ounces, Jocelyn. She is beautiful. Demetri stands up to hug her, pulls out her chair, while Ashley gives a little side hug from her chair. She's smart. She's playing it cool. And then we really just get right down to brass tacks. Why polygamy? Ashley says it's not because of religion. She just likes that tribe, community, nature of it. And she says that she's also not a jealous type and she's not going to mind sharing Demetri. She also says that she doesn't have a limit on the amount of kids that she's willing to have, carry, or care for. At this, Dimitri cannot hide his satisfaction in their choice. But Ashley is more like me. She's a bit more curious if Jocelyn is really answering her truth, or if she's just answering what she thinks the right answer should be. Well, Dimitri is now like a kid who wants to go get ice cream after you just ate lunch at the theme park. He asked Jocelyn if she would like to go on a date with him that same evening. If that's okay with you, Ashley. You know, you take care of the kids while I go out and wine and dine her. Ashley's cool with it. I don't know with this couple. I just don't have a real feel for them yet. I'm curious to see if they all really end up together. I just feel like there is some jealousy on Ashley's part. Let's head due west now, my apples, to the Aldridges of Utah. Fun fact, Aspen Brown of the My Sister Wives Closet dynasty is now engaged to the pioneer woman Vanessa Aldridge's little brother. Yeah, let that crossover blow your mind as we dive into this polygamy pond. Jeff, Charisse, Vanessa, and all the kids are making welcome signs for Melina's arrival. They've kind of maxed out getting to know her on Skype, so they're excited to finally have her in Utah, get to know her in person. Charisse is especially invested in this because she's developed a friendship with Melina on her own. We have a resident comedian in the house. Jeff cracks a wise one about Melina being a predator after all his money. Predator is an interesting word to use for a man with wives half his age. And even Charisse pipes in with, yeah, because you have so much. Burn. Meanwhile, in Marquette, Michigan, which is in the UP, a tatted up Melina and her friend make their way to the beach for a leisurely stroll. You guys wear leather boots and floor-length skirts to the beach, right? God, did I cringe when I saw that friend in those boots and that skirt sinking into the shoreline with each step. I'd kill my friend if she made me do that on camera nonetheless. So Melina and this friend named Jen sit down on the beach so Melina's dog could attack Jen while Melina got her moment to try and convince us why a woman with a full sleeve would want to convert to Mormonism and take care of other people's kids all day for free. I think Charisse is nice. I haven't gotten a chance to talk to Vanessa. It seems like she doesn't want to talk to me. And Jeff, I'm just not sure yet. I think right here is where Melina was planting that seed of blame straight at Vanessa because she doesn't want to get to know me. Clearly, Melina's friend thinks she's nuts, but I don't know if the friend is acting just as Melina is too. Well, the day of truth is here. Charisse climbs into the back seat while Vanessa and Jeff hold hands. Again, I don't like all this affection around the other wives. Take note from Cody Brown. Dear God, what am I saying? Oh, I'm going to need a drink after this one. Anyway, Vanessa is awfully quiet as Jeff admits he's excited to text Melina in the morning. Weird. And Charisse is acting all giddy, like it's her first day of school and she's going to find her new best friend who already feels like a sister to me. They arrive at the airport and they're waiting. And waiting and waiting. And the producer breaks the fourth wall to ask, how you guys feeling? They say they're hopeful until they try calling her. And Melina doesn't pick up. Charisse starts crying and says, I'm stuck in the middle. I'll send her another message. Even if she weren't in the family, we were friends. Just let me know everything's okay. Exactly what many of us are probably feeling. Why not just find a friend? Why do they have to sleep with your husband and cut your kids' pancakes? I need to see how this one shakes out because I just smell something pathological on Melina. Well, here we are with the Briny women of Utah. But actually, since this show, they've moved to Oregon. And that actually does suck that they keep having to move state to state because they fear prosecution and jail. Because you know what? Unless someone is hurting kids or breaking the law, I'm looking at you, Centennial Park, FLDS. Just let people do their thing. I mean, look at the Browns. What? The biggest crime they've done is lip sync and wear horrible leggings. And they brought us Tony, okay? Well, back to the Brinies and their new home. Arlie is having a situation with April. Arlie's boys need new mattresses, but April has been giving her a hard time about it. This seems to be a pattern, according to Arlie, that April manipulates situations in order to get better or nicer or more advantageous things for her and her kids. So Drew gathers Arlie, April, and Angela around to get to the bottom of it. Immediately, April's on the defensive because she quite harshly asks, "Why is Angela here? Is she involved? Do you have a take on this?" And you know what? I think I love Angela because she didn't hesitate to bite back to April. "Yeah, I have a take on it." Because of her confidence and her quick-mindedness, if that's a word, I'm going to let the nude lipstick slide. April says she was just trying to be nice by giving Arlie some extra mattresses that were just lying around. Now, I'm certain we all know people like April in our own lives. They know to just say enough to make it sound like what they're doing is innocent. They assume other people don't see the manipulation, but we all do. Like Arlie says, it stinks to be in that position, especially so when you have to live with the person. With Angela in the mix now, Arlie has a little pep in her step and some fire under her ass to stick up for herself and her kids. And not for nothing, Arlie is very direct in telling April specifically what bothers her. She gets enough guts to say what I think would be incredibly hard to say to someone like April. "I view what you're doing as manipulative and dishonest." Angela instantly becomes the social worker slash family therapist in this situation and tries to urge April to see that this isn't just about the mattresses. "You're a wackadoodle, and we see you for who you are. You're not fooling us. You're just making yourself look crazy." Things get heated in no time, and we go to a commercial break. We never got a resolution in that scene, but all of a sudden, we're in the same kitchen, different time, and all the wives are sitting down again to go at it. April, with her creepy smile, she thinks that this smile is tricking people into thinking she's sincere, and she tells Angela and Arlie that she's the real victim here. She feels ganged up on, that they give her dirty looks, they talk behind her back, and poor April. Arlie, as a first wife, "I picked you. I chose you." And Angela, "I brought you in and I chose you, and I don't think you would choose me." Whoa, full on team Arlie and Angela. That wasn't just manipulative, that was scary. April's ease and joy in shaping this narrative that she's a martyr is beyond disturbing. She, in my opinion, she needs some therapeutic intervention because this behavior and thought processing is, well, it's something I wouldn't want to be around, nor would I want my children to be around. Once again, Angela really stands firm here. "That a girl, stand your ground, set that precedence nice and early, what you're willing to take and not take from April." She says, "We would choose you. We chose the family. But if you want a friend, you have to be friendly." Always on the defensive and never willing to be accountable, April deflects and Angela just lays it out there. She might as well, because no matter what she says, April's going to go mental. "To be honest, April, I don't have the best feelings for you." And then April just runs off like Tamara Barney on a Real Housewives vacation. Later in her basement apartment, April is complaining to Amandel's wearing Drew, that Arlie and Angela are big meanies to her, and she's always the last on the list. Drew tiptoes around the idea that maybe April might want to try and wonder why. Is it possible that perhaps there's some truth to what everyone else is seeing in her behavior? Maybe there's a common denominator to the equation. One word, two syllables, sounds like Maypril. And then in a moment, we think April has come to her senses, and you see a light bulb go off in her head. You know what? I just realized I'm not sticking up for myself. I need to talk with them. I'm going to tell them what I need, whether they receive it or not, and it's on them. Okay, Bunny Boiler. I'm not going to be ignored, Dan. Back for round three, this time on the exact same couch as McKelty had in her May's apartment, April says, I've been examining my heart. You two are dead wrong. That's not who I am. Angela freezes in shock. Arlie is also frozen and in a paralyzed fight or flight mode. And April starts petting Arlie. It was not only downright creepy, that's emotionally abusive, right? I mean, she's exerting fear and physically getting into someone's space. It was actually hard to watch, right? Angela snaps to for only a moment to try and get back on track and says maybe they should each just come up with one goal that they are going to work on with themselves. April will go first. Arlie, I want you to say something nice to me every day. I need affirmations from you, as she continues to pet her. I mean, imagine if April's willing to do this on camera. What does she act like when the cameras are not around? I would have loved for Angela and Arlie to call April on this bullshit right then and there, but I get it. They are dealing with someone who isn't right mentally, and they'll never be able to get through to her because April needs actual medical and professional intervention, in my opinion. So for the moment, Arlie reluctantly says she wants April to be able to express herself and allows April to hug her awkwardly. Now, I'm all for families to be able to live together, but maybe this is just one of those cases where it's best that the wives live separately, have a cul-de-sac or some townhouses or apartments near one another, because I don't think staying together for the kids is going to work with this one. Hang in there, Arlie and Angela. You have the orchard on your side. That does it for our little adventure down Polygamy Street. Join me later this week for Teen Mom, Married at First Sight, and Love After Lockup. If you want to know the details of that Married at First Sight contract and compensation, head on over to patreon.com/realitybpod. And everywhere else on social media at Reality TV Pod. It's getting cold out here in the Midwest, so bundle up, buttercups, and stay salty.